It's Wednesday, May 8th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, one of the nation's oldest newspapers, bought by its crosstown rival, putting more than 160 journalists out of a job. What led to the very sudden sale of the New Orleans Times-Picayune? Facebook wades into censorship with a move to ban several far-right figures from the platform, including Alex Jones and Louis Farrakhan. And a Game of Thrones goof has hardcore fans laughing. We'll talk about what happened and the reaction. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up this week. But we're going to start with the release of two Reuters journalists from a prison in Myanmar. Walion and Kya So-u had been sentenced to 7 years for breaking a State Secrets Act in their coverage of the killing of 10 Rohingya Muslim men and boys during an army crackdown a year ago, August. This was a big surprise. It was part of a widespread amnesty that 2 weeks ago didn't look like it was going to happen.
It didn't look like the two journalists were going to be released.
Right.
Anyway.
The amnesty was going to happen, but they weren't going to be included.
And that's part of the reason probably why it happened, because the government was releasing like 6,000 other prisoners around the traditional New Year there. But also there have been a lot of negotiations going on behind the scenes. There's been all kinds of international condemnation of what's been going on there. The court proceedings were finally up. All their appeals were up. So now the government could make a pardon, quote unquote. So there's lots of reasons why it might have been happening. I wish I could say that beyond the good news for those two journalists that it signified much more.
Yeah, I don't know if it signified much more, but I think the international pressure was really starting to mount up, and the annual releasing of prisoners and the commutation of sentences gave them an opportunity to sort of get the international pressure off of their backs. I do think that their winning of the Pulitzer Prizes, was it last week or week before, also sort of ramped up that pressure. You know, you've got two award-winning journalists locked up on trumped-up charges, and all their appeals are out, and they're looking at serving seven-year sentences, which would have kept that narrative going. And the government was like, okay, we have an out, let's take it.
And I guess the reason why I sort of offered that cynical take at the end of my comment was just that I worry it really doesn't signify that much more. These two journalists, they say they're anxious to get back to work. Are they going to be allowed to work doing what they were doing in Myanmar?
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, my guess is that they're probably going to continue to work for Reuters, but
in another location. My first thought, if I'm them, is how fast can I get out of Myanmar?
Right.
Plus, there are, I believe, since the quote democratically elected government started sharing power with the military, there have been more than 40 journalists arrested there, many of them still imprisoned. And this is all under a government that, again, is sharing power with someone who used to be considered a human rights activist, Aung San Suu Kyi, and yet she seems to be willing to look the other way at not only what happened to these journalists, but the whole reason the journalists were there covering the genocide of the Rohingya people, and you don't see much happening to make their situation any better either.
Okay, well, there was another defamation case that was overturned Monday in Turkey. We are seeing some of these efforts to try and shine a brighter light on some of these censorship or this jailing of journalists going on worldwide. We are seeing a louder drum on that than perhaps we have in recent months or years.
Yeah, I think there's the pressure that's coming from the worldwide journalism community that instead of sort of, it's a story, we're going to cover it. I mean, they are shining a huge light on it. They're keeping the pressure up. The journalism organizations themselves are actually pushing this. The owners of the journalism organizations are pushing it. So I think that's having a somewhat of an impact on it, but I also think that there's this huge concern in terms of the rise of populism and what's happening there that's also fueling some of this pushback.
Right.
So Thursday afternoon, I got a really cryptic note from a friend of mine about something happening in New Orleans at the Times-Picayune. Then I saw a status on Facebook from one of my former bosses who had been working there as a digital editor, saying that it had been one of the most rewarding stops in his career. I was confused about what was happening. Well, it seems the Times-Picayune, one of the oldest and most storied newspapers in the South had just been bought out by its main competitor, and all 161 journalists working there were given notice that they are likely going to be out of a job. What does this mean? Well, here's a clip from WWL-TV. One of its reporters tried to sort it out for viewers.
We're going to try to expand our suburban coverage. We're going to try to expand our, you know, sports coverage. You can't cover the Saints enough.
While there was some excitement at the Advocate office, just down the street at the Times-Picayune, there was a different mood.
For the NOLA.com employees, what does this mean for them? Will there be layoffs?
I can't speak for Advance Local, but I can tell you that we're looking to add to our editorial team. We'll be adding jobs, and we'll be looking for people to handle the increased business and the coverage that we're going to need.
Advocate publisher Dan Shea says the goal is to try to bring back what he says was lost when the newspaper war launched in 2012.
That's what we're going to try to recreate, the Times-Picayune, when it was at its peak.
So what we had here, you heard that 2012 year, this local newspaper war, and David bought out Goliath.
Yes, and this has happened before in other times. I remember when the San Antonio, you had it happen in San Antonio, you had it happen in other areas. And basically, New Orleans is unique in the fact that when Katrina hit, before Katrina, there was 275,000 was their circulation. After Katrina, it dropped to 100,000 or less. The Times-Picayune was bought out by another company.
Advance Local
had bought it out, and they were trying to basically operate it on a shoestring. I mean, it dropped to 3 days a week publication, and the rest was digital. That didn't work. And then in comes the Advocate, which is based in Baton Rouge, but mm-hmm. It came into New Orleans because it saw an opening. And it used that opening to basically build up a base and go after the Times-Picayune, and was able to undercut it. And a lot of what happened was the Times-Picayune and Advance's fault more so than the Advocate.
And you had, I mean, the Times-Picayune has done great journalism in the past. They have been owned by a corporation not based in the South for a long time. Here you have the Advocate coming in and doing good journalism too, and they are locally owned. So if one of the companies was going to end up buying out the other, that's probably the right way for it to happen. Nonetheless, and yeah, I mean, you heard the guy talk about we're going to expand sports, we're going to expand suburban coverage, but there are a whole lot of employees over at the Times-Picayune, all of them having to basically resign and then maybe apply for some additional jobs with the Advocate. So a lot of good journalists are going to lose their jobs.
I mean, I do take issue with his statement that we're going to bring this back to what the Times-Picayune was. That's not going to happen because
Times-Picayune is dead. Right, that brand has it is going
absolutely.
Away.
But even more so than that, you don't have the population, and you have a different makeup of the city of New Orleans. I mean, it's not the same. I mean, in terms of the people who are there, those who are coming in, they don't see the Times-Picayune in the same way that you saw prior to Katrina.
I mean, I guess it's going to be a really interesting experiment, because as I read the coverage, they were actually going to use both papers' names combined for
That's
a while.
Going to be interesting.
For a while. We'll see how that works. But going back to a 7-day-a-week print publication, that runs counter to just about everything else that's happening in local news, whether it's in large markets or small. I wish them good luck with that, because that city needs good journalism. And if they can make a model for how other community journalists can do that, good.
Okay, well, who knows how many times we've talked about this next topic. If we were to say it was until we were blue in the face, it would have to be Facebook blue. What is the platform going to do to curb the harmful content spread across its network? Well, it did something, and it did something that is also drawing criticism. Last week, it banned several far-right figures, including InfoWars chief Alex Jones, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, and Milo Yiannopoulos. It wasn't even a year ago, though, that Facebook was defending those very people's rights to publish to its platform.
So you could ask what's different, and what's different, of course, is what we've been talking about almost every episode for the past half year or so. Facebook is under increasing pressure from regulators abroad and in the United States. They're under extreme pressure to deal with violations of people's privacy. So this is a way for them to look like they're doing something good. Banning a small number of people who engage in hate speech or misinformation, okay, that's not a bad thing. But what happens when the next person crops up, and the next person, the next person? And I don't know, from a free speech perspective, and I'm not defending Alex Jones or any of those other folks, but from a free speech perspective, do we want a company, a private company, that does not have to uphold the First Amendment, that's not their charge, to be in charge of managing the public conversation, if that means their rules are going to ban people who may be in gray areas and not quite as bright as some of these hate speech advocates?
Yeah, I mean, you start to fall into that sort of slippery slope paradigm here when you start down the road of we're going to ban these people, but we're going to allow these people. And to go back to your point about, you know, these communities, Facebook has allowed these communities to engage with each other. And in this zeal to say that, you know, this is a democratization of social media and of the internet and that, what you're finding is that, no, this is part of it as well has been the polarization. It's been the hate speech and that sort of thing. But another point to this is the fact that Facebook is a business. And if they can ban these people and sort of get away with that and increase their brand over here, then that's going to help them. And I think that was part of the PR move that they were trying to make here, but I don't think it's been very helpful.
Well, and I have to wonder how effective it truly can be, and how much of this is just a PR move, because you can ban Alex Jones, but are you going to be able to effectively ban every single person who shares Alex Jones's content from another platform within the Facebook universe?
They claim that they're going to try that. And even if they can pull it off, I don't know where you draw the line between someone who says, I'm sympathetic with an argument that Alex Jones or somebody else made, before you get too far down the road of violating people's right to engage in a conversation. The other thing about this is that Facebook wants to have its cake and eat it too. At the same time that it's trying to look like we're helping to decrease hate speech online, they're also saying, we want to be, what did he say? Mark Zuckerberg said, the future is private the other day.
Right.
They're doing everything they can to move any speech that is questionable behind encryption so that people can't see and hear it till it's too late.
You know, and it's very interesting. So when you go back and, like, as you said, we've been talking about Facebook for a year and a half now and all the issues that they face. But, you know, at one point, Facebook was basically saying, no, we're open to everybody. And we're aggregators. We're not content providers. We don't make content. Well, now, all of a sudden, they're pulling back and saying, well, we get to pick and choose what we aggregate and who gets to engage in our platform. I mean, it goes back to what you said. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You know, at some point, you're going to have to figure out which direction you're going to go, and everyone follows in that direction, and this is your business model and also how you're going to operate.
And to be consistent with it
over time.
A lot of people, individuals and organizations, found themselves having to backtrack on something they had shared on social media last week, including the Reynolds Journalism Institute. It was a piece from Pointer that listed unreliable news sources. The biggest problem with it? Most of those listed were far right leaning, without balancing out with publications on the far left. Take a listen to this critique, which aired on Fox News Channel.
Conveniently, many of the far-left news sites were left out of that. Think Progress, for example, which is run out of the Center for American Progress and The Intercept. So very clearly, conservative news sites were targeted, and most alarmingly, they were targeted to be blacklisted by advertisers. So what this Journalism Institute is really supporting here is choking out conservative news sites from the public through boycotts and bans via advertisers. That is not something anyone who supports journalism should ever be behind.
I always say that news organizations, like, their politics don't necessarily have to align with my politics, but I listen to that And I got to think that's a really fair critique.
It is. And not only is it a question of, are most of the ones on the site on the right rather, or on the list on the right rather than the left, but they were also commingling conservative news organizations with think tanks and conspiracy theory sites. It just wasn't a very good method for trying to delineate news sites that are unreliable. And as you mentioned, I mean, we have a little egg on our face here. I mean, lots of new institutes like us and Pointer, we share each other's content, and we did that.
But we're also transparent enough to say afterwards, you know, okay, they've pulled it. We're going to say to, we're backing off of that too. And
but also, I mean, the person who is responsible for putting this list together was a fellow here at RJI, not working on that subject when he was here. But then he went to work for the Southern Poverty Law Center, which, as we all know, has been quite controversial for a while. And some of their lists of hate speech, you know, are also questionable. So they had to withdraw this whole list. And the person who wrote it, I think, maybe had some biases of his own going into it.
Well, you know, this goes back to a broader issue that we've talked about, which is, you know, I think the maybe one of the points that Pointer and others in putting this list together and disseminating it were trying to get to was we're trying to help the public to discern what is good information, what is bad information, what's truthful, accurate, and factual, and what is not. The problem with that is when you do that, you open yourself up to this kind of criticism. If we were better as a society and as a culture in educating media literacy, news media literacy, how you can think for yourself whether or not a story is accurate and it has all the facts, if we were better at that, then there probably wouldn't be a need for lists like this.
So you raise a really good point there. At the same time, what is the role of, you know, Pointer used to call itself a think tank. Now it calls itself a school for journalists. What is the role of an institute such as a Pointer or a Nieman at Harvard or a Reynolds Journalism Institute here at Missouri? Where and how then do those institutes fit into that environment of building that media literacy education or providing some of that in a more unbiased way that helps provide that information and that literacy down the line?
How many shows do we have to talk about this topic? But I mean, an institute like that or like ours is basically trying to say, we want to improve the quality of journalism. And the quality of journalism needs to be improved because one, it's under attack, and two, citizens need good journalism now more than they ever have. But if we start wading into these ideological swamps and we're perceived, in this instance, perhaps accurately, as having taken a side, then we can't fulfill that mission. People are going to be suspicious of us. Already plenty of people are. We shouldn't give them more ammunition to question our motives.
Okay. So let's talk about sports for a bit. Two sports stories came across the desk this week. The first, Sinclair Broadcast Group is getting into the game, paying Disney $10.5 billion for 21 regional Fox Sports networks. Fox Sports Midwest, the channel that we oftentimes see Blues games or the Cardinals or the Royals here in town, part of that package.
Yes, I mean, it was Fox, when Disney bought Fox, part of the issue was that Disney also owns ESPN. And the federal government basically said, well, you can't have that kind of monopoly where you're owning both Fox
Find
Sports
yourself a buyer.
And ESPN. Find somebody to buy that. Well, Sinclair jumps in. They buy those Fox regionals. At least they put in a bid to buy the Fox regionals. And now that moves Sinclair into, if I remember correctly, they would be the second largest owner of sporting broadcasts in the country. And but the flip side to that is that they're taking on more debt. They're taking on a huge amount of debt in order to do this. And the question becomes, are they going to be able to see a return on that investment as people continue to cut the cord on cable and satellite?
Yeah, and when you look at it at face value, that's a big question. I mean, people are leaving cable and satellite, but sports is one of the sort of exceptions to the rule in terms of viewership. People are still watching sports on cable and on satellite as well as online for one really good reason.
It's live.
It's live. Yeah. And that means for a company like Sinclair and those advertisers that support it, people are less likely to avoid the ads when something is on live. Still, you're saying put that much money into it? I don't know. But here's a part of the deal that I think is interesting for Sinclair. They own all these local TV stations, but they don't have a huge presence in cable. One of the big sticking points for local television stations is they have to renegotiate transmission fees all the time with the cable companies. And if you own big sports properties that are popular and these cable vendors, you know, the Comcasts of the world, they want those channels, maybe they're going to negotiate a better deal to continue carrying the local stations. So it might not be as sketchy a business plan for Sinclair as it might look on the surface.
One of the other things that's really interesting to me about this is, you know, you talk about the television station ownership groups across the country. You've got the really big ones. You've got the Tegna, which used to be Gannett before it spun off. You've got Tribune, which is about to be purchased. You've got Nexstar. You've got some of these really large groups, but they're all on the local level. Sinclair is really the first one to make this huge jump into cable as well and onto this national level and have that type of exposure going too.
I mean, it's interesting the way they're doing it.
They're doing it in a niche.
They're doing it through sports. I mean, they have a piece of the YES Network, which is affiliated with the Yankees. They're working with the Chicago Cubs
to be the exclusive carrier of all Cubs games.
So they're doing it in this niche that goes back to what Mike was talking about, which is the one area where people are still willing to shell out money to watch live events, and that's sports.
Let's take one slightly longer view than that. Mm-hmm. Sinclair has always wanted to be in the business of being a conservative news network going up against Fox News. If you get your toehold into cable the way that they're doing now, that might set you up for that kind of situation down the road.
Okay, so the Super Bowl, it's a long way off, but there's some news about that this week, too. For people who don't particularly like football, it's all about the commercials. Well, Fox says it's going to try something new with next year's Super Bowl. It's going to cut one commercial break per quarter, but they're not going to be cutting any of the commercial inventory because those breaks are going to be a little bit longer.
Yeah, I wondered how that's going to work. They've been experimenting with the playoff games, the games that lead up to the Super Bowl, and been doing it in mm-hmm. these four-block arrangements. And now they want to carry that to the Super Bowl to see whether or not it helps the flow of the game and they don't lose audience and that sort of thing.
Is the Super Bowl supposed to have flow to the game? Is it about football?
Well, for some people, it is.
Okay.
You know, some people, it is.
That's where Ernest and I are on different sides of the table. Ernest wants flow to the game.
But, I mean, as you say, they've been experimenting with this outside the Super Bowl for one really good reason. I mean, research shows that there's a perception problem that is solved by doing fewer breaks. People believe, you know, if there are fewer breaks, that the game is moving faster.
Right, right.
And we always talk about how baseball or football or whatever, it just takes forever for these broadcasts. People think they're going faster if there are fewer commercial breaks. If that means more people stick around, more people see the advertising, then those huge fees that people like Fox have to pay these sports leagues now, that they might be able to justify.
I mean, you're actually even seeing, you know, sports experimenting with in these having commercial breaks, but the games are still going on.
And a squeeze back, so that you can still see it.
So you're seeing them do that ad impression without it being
a complete and total disruption.
And I think what they're learning here is that, you know, if you can keep it in a two-hour window, 2 to 2.5 hour window, then you're going to be able to actually deal with that flow of the game issue there. If you watch the NBA, they figured it out. And now the other sports are trying to pick up on that.
Here's why it's a good time to do this if you're Fox. The ratings for the Super Bowl the past couple of years have been up. Advertising revenues have been up. They're just now going into what we call the upfronts, where they negotiate advertising packages for the next TV season. So things are all positive for Fox right now. That's a better time to be experimenting with this, even if it doesn't work, than when you're not doing so well.
Right.
Okay, so before we go, Mike, this one, it's for you.
Eagle-eyed Game of Thrones fans caught something really out of place on the hit show. The medieval esque fantasy drama featured a table scene last night with a cup almost everyone can recognize right in front of you. Can you make out the Starbucks cup? Where is it? Come on, can somebody see this thing here? There's oh, there it is. Okay, wait, move. You got, all right, well.
There it is.
I think he's even got the green straw in it, for goodness sakes. It is a hilarious oversight on an otherwise meticulously crafted show.
That is a huge oversight for this show. They have gone so far out of their way for how many seasons? Because I know you've watched every single episode.
This is the eighth season.
Okay, so
and
they
the
have
final
gone,
season.
So they have gone out of their way to make sure that every single thing is perfect in this period piece.
Because this is the gem of quality TV on HBO. It's the biggest show with the highest ratings. It's the flagship for HBO. So yes, they have been trying to make it as good. They spent millions and millions of dollars on this final season that only has six episodes in it. So this was
this
a little
was
bit
what,
of a blackout.
Episode three or four?
That was episode four. We had two more. Last episode, episode four. Here's the deal, though. I think HBO is actually glad to have this coffee cup fiasco out there, because there were fans who were actually super fans who were much more upset with HBO and Game of Thrones for other things that may not sound that big to you or me. Well, maybe to me. There was a problem with how dark the previous episode was, the biggest battle in the history of Game of Thrones, the Battle of Winterfell.
What, dark like
so
we
dark.
Couldn't see, or dark like, because I know that Game of Thrones can have like mega violence and like dark and like mood.
Dark
as opposed
actually
to what
in the sense
of,
I can't see what's going
okay, very
on
good. Okay.
Because it was a night battle in winter with snow, and the whole idea of the producers was, well, let's make it feel like that. And
I'm
then there were viewers
going, watch you
I can't
out.
See this.
Okay.
But here's an even bigger one.
Yeah.
Why would anyone care about this? Well, a lot of people
do.
Tell
us, please.
The Battle of Winterfell had some of the worst military tactics you have ever seen anywhere. Why would, and it's bled over into this next episode, and so you've got people arguing point by point. I mean, military experts and other folks getting, why didn't the dragons come in from behind? Why did you send your cavalry in first to be des-? All these things that really get people excited, but it also makes people critical of the show. They'd much rather have us talking about coffee cups than talking about the internal logic of the scripts for the show.
I'm so happy that you're happy.
Now
about
do you know everything you ever needed to know?
The two of us, Ernest and I, are sitting here. We're just watching Mike with like these little grins on our faces as he's geeking out about this.
Well,
over here.
I'm happy that he feels this way, so that people can understand the way I feel about my Marvel movies. You know, so I'm okay with it. You know,
And this is why I adore working with both of you, because I get to see each of you excited about these things each
Only
week.
Two more episodes ever for Game of Thrones. It's going to be some real withdrawal pains for people when we finally get to the conclusion of this series.
There you have it, Views of the News viewers and listeners. May 22nd, we're asking Mike about the end of Game of Thrones. Well, we are just about out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today, including lots of reaction about that coffee cup, on our links blog. You can find that under both the programs and talk shows tab at kbia.org. We're also on iTunes, Spotify, all of those places where you find your favorite podcasts. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.